Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everyone. I think we're having a heat wave up here. It's 38 degrees. Oh, my God. I cannot believe it. Yesterday was minus two. The sun is shining, and we have a phenomenal book, a great author, and you're going to just love this craziness. Private investigator Charlie Miner, freshly revived from his own murder, not bad, gets a call from homicide detective David Putnam. Self-styled psychic to the stars, Tamara Gale has given crucial information about three murders, and the brass thinks it makes the department look bad. Dave wants Charlie to help figure out the angle since he has first-hand experience with the inexplicable. It's pretty good to be dead and come back. The trouble is, Charlie's just weeks after his full-death experience, once again, has severe cognitive problems and may get them both killed. That would not be good because that would have ruined the whole thing. So you've got
right
some phenomenal accolades. Yeah, you got some phenomenal accolades on the back. And Noel Jaworski is here. So good morning, and I can't wait to get started. How are you today?
Well, I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm okay. It's warm up here, finally.
Yeah.
So how did you create this story? What is the backstory between Charlie and Dave? What can you tell us about those two, and how did you create that first scene?
Oh, boy. Okay, there's a handful right out of the gate. So, you know, I'm not even a supernatural kind of reader. I mean, I started off when I was a kid. I loved science fiction, but Stephen King and that kind of thing, I don't read it much. I have no idea why. I sat down one day, and a page spilled out where a guy wakes up looking down at his body in the morgue, and he looks down at it and it pulls him in. And as he gets closer, it absorbs him and he finds out that he can reanimate it and move around. And so his mission right from the start, and this is in the first Charlie Miner book, is to go out and find out who killed him. But since he's also, or had been a heroin addict, his primary objective before he goes on his mission to find out who kills him is to go get high. So he's sort of dually motivated. I have no idea where all that came from. I had a page of weirdness that I kind of fleshed out into 10 pages that maybe was going somewhere. And then for a year, I had no idea what to do with it. So I just sat on it. So, that's how that started. Now, he, in the first book, he had had some previous, as a private investigator, he had run into this cop, Dave Putnam, a few times. They'd knocked back a few beers together, worked on a couple cases together, and then somehow they intersect in the first Charlie Miner book. And in this new one, the sequel, Down to No Good, they work very closely together.
Well, they are a unique pair, I'll tell you that.
They are.
I thought about that. You know, I read a book a long time ago, and one of the authors was actually doing this, where if somebody's dead and they get you within, she said, 6 to 8 hours, and you do certain kind of therapy on them, that actually you could revive somebody that's dead. So I said, well, that's really, and it's real. Some kind of thermal therapy. And unfortunately, it didn't work when they did it with my sister, but they try with others. So how did Charlie survive his own murder? And how does he wind up? That must have been really cool. He woke up in the morgue. How does someone who's dead come back to repair himself in life? Because if we knew the trick, Earl, then the rest of us would, you know, definitely send it to some of our people that are gone and see if we can bring them back.
Sure. Well, you know, too clever about it, but I have to ask you back, how do shape-shifting demons become clowns who live in sewer drains? You know, that's the Stephen King book that they just turned into the movie. If you're in the movie asking that, you probably should go to a different theater and watch something more your stuff, because there is no answer. There's just not an answer. You either buy it or you don't. I suppose you could refer to the story of Jesus and Lazarus, and he wakes Lazarus from the dead. And so if you buy into the narrative that this is possible by any means, There's no way to get scientific about it. But actually, you know what? If you believe that consciousness can exist separate from a body, then that opens up all kinds of questions, doesn't it?
Well, there are a lot of people that have near-death experiences where they think that they're floating over their bodies and see themselves,
right,
and then they come back in. Yeah. I've read a lot about that, and that probably could happen. But I've got the first chapter here.
But they don't have bullets in their head.
No, not like he does. No, not like a bullet in
his
head.
Right.
That seems scary.
Go on. Okay, well, then you've got, like, okay, you know what an axolotl is? It's this weird creature. It's kind of like a salamander. And they can regenerate limbs. You cut off a leg and they'll grow a new one. So somehow in us, there are instructions for rebuilding parts of our body. And maybe it's just possible. I don't know. It's pretty out there, I know. Maybe we could tune into that and do it deliberately, which is what Charlie does when he repairs his body. I know it's far-fetched, but, you know, it's fiction.
Well, they're replacing brains, and they're doing face transplants and they're doing leg transplants and heart transplants. Well, you never know. They could do a body transplant.
Right. That's right.
I think there was something on Boston Globe the other day, and Google, that said that they took somebody's head and transplanted it to somebody's body. I don't think I would want to be the person that they... Oh, I don't know. That's so weird. And how do you react to someone else's body, but you've got a different brain and a different person?
Well, I don't know if they've done that and made it work yet. Some guy did it with monkeys,
so.
I know. They did it with monkeys, and there are people now that are spending huge amounts of money, including, I forget, I think some baseball player with a lot of money that died a long time ago. He had his head removed and cryogenically it's frozen. Basically, it's sitting somewhere.
Yeah.
Technology to catch up to his wish to be reanimated on a new body. You know, I wish him the best.
I think
Walt Disney's
been waiting for that also, because he had his head cryogenically, whatever, a long time ago. And yeah, I think he's still waiting. I think
now
he's not going to thaw out. I doubt it. So,
how did you create
the first? I like Walt Disney too. That's so sad. How did you create the first scene that sets the tone for the way... How does Charlie react when he realizes he's in a morgue and he's dead? He was dead and he's got a bullet in his head. What was his first reaction to this whole thing?
Well, he's surprised. He's mystified, but again, like I mentioned before, he had been a heroin addict, and so his sort of primal urge is to go continue... Mm-hmm. to do what addicts do, which is to get himself right. And he's also mystified by his condition, not only that he's been able to reanimate his body, but what happened to his body in the first place. So he has a dual mission. He has to go. He's just compelled to go do that. He's not that much into questioning the esoteric condition of his unknowable condition. He gets to that later.
Yeah, I know, we're not going to tell him. So, who is Dave, and why does he know what happened to Charlie, and how does he get him back to himself? Well, I'd like to have a friend like that, too, to help a few people get back to themselves. Seriously. And then he takes his body and dumps it back in the seat of his car and takes him home, and nobody sees it. How did you create that? I mean, that's too cool. That's too wild. God.
Okay, well, there's backstory to that, which is in the end of the first book. Well, boy, that was there. That would be a spoiler. Okay, spoiler alert: if anyone's going to read the first book, Charlie winds up in the same condition that he started in, which is that he doesn't make it through the end of the first book. Dave is Charlie's friend. They've developed a friendship throughout the first book by working together. It's kind of a weird friendship. But at the end, Dave rescues Charlie's body because he knows that if he leaves Charlie's body, he knows that Charlie has this weird ability to regenerate himself. But he also knows that if Charlie gets taken to the morgue again and is not left unattended, that he's going to be sliced and diced and not be revivable. So he brings him home to see what will happen. And he's sort of, what's the Udi Sid Shiva? Is that how that goes? Sort of does that, waiting for him to, I don't know what. He doesn't know what.
Well, all I know is that if you're going to continue the series, Charlie better not wind up in the morgue again. Poor thing.
No. That's right.
So before he died, they were good friends, you said. So who is Mindy? And why doesn't she freak out when she sees her father alive? I mean, my sister died, my niece is still freaking out. And in her backyard, she's got, this is the truth, she's got a plaque with my sister's face on it. It actually looks like my sister. It's in gold. And she talks to it every day. I said, now, if you can get me and get her to answer you, that would be great. But some people actually do that. So how does she feel when she finds out her father's not dead? Or does she know this from before?
No, actually, Mindy's not aware of what happened to her dad she just doesn't understand the entire weirdness that he's living in. If you haven't read the book, you don't know that it's told in first person by Charlie. It's narrated by Charlie. I'm talking about the first book. The second book is half Charlie's story, half the cop Dave story. But Charlie tells it first person in present tense. So he's telling you things as they go along. And my hope is that the immediacy of that point of view and that present tense storytelling takes you past the weirdness of his condition, because he's as surprised as we are about what's happening and trying to unravel the mystery of it. Now, so Mindy isn't aware that he ever wound up in the morgue in the first place. She knows something strange is going on, but not that strange. Anyway, Mindy's Charlie's 16-year-old daughter. She's kind of a wild child herself. She's got, you know, purple streaks in her hair, hoops in her
That's
nose.
That's me too.
Oh, okay. There you go. Well, good.
Yeah, me too. You got it.
Okay.
Me too.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Purple streaks are good. It's what makes you. I have blue, green, red, yellow, orange, and purple. I'm serious. And I really
guess.
Do, but you see, no wonder I like Mindy so much. I mean, yeah, purple streaks are great.
Uh-huh.
So, what is his relationship with his daughter, and why do we know that they both use drugs to get high? Not a good thing.
Well, no, I mean, Mindy's actually more stable than it appears. Charlie has an ex-wife that's a raging alcoholic. She's hostile to both of them. Charlie sort of rescues Mindy from the crazy house, where she lives with her mom. And so Mindy smokes some weed to get rid of, to sort of calm down the demons in her own head that are going to be generated when you have a parent or even parents like Mindy has. Charlie came across drug addiction by way of an injury and pain medication. And when that stopped working, he escalated. And there's, there's sort of a sub-theme here that speaks to a condition we've got happening on a national level, which is, you've heard about the opioid crisis. There's a lot of people
there's a lot of people
that don't fit the old demographic of heroin addiction. They didn't start out partying and smoking weed and drinking too much and moving on to heavier drugs and finally winding up junkies. They just did a shortcut from pain pills to heroin. And,
well, I believe it will. I'm doing a show on February 8th on opiates, to be very exact.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Kay Genovese's son died from an overdose of drugs. I'm interviewing her with a reporter, Mike Henry, that wrote a book about the same thing about a young teen, his son. So I'm just looking for somebody that's well-versed in it. And, you're right, because you go to the doctor, which I did the other day, and I told him, I explained the situation to him, which he understood. And when I went to the pharmacy, I went to pick up Motrin or Tylenol, and he had prescribed prednisone and Percocet, and I told the pharmacist to put it back on the shelf. I would never take it, ever. I said, I could deal with what's wrong. I just don't want to deal with that. So that's one thing that, yeah, that's important. So how does he convince Mindy to go back to school and give up the weed? I mean, because there's a lot of things on the news about marijuana too, cannabis, you know, legal and not legal. And that's another good topic. So how does he convince her to go back to school?
He tells her he doesn't. Her alternative is to go back to her mom, and that craziness.
Yeah.
Avoiding that craziness is a pretty good incentive. So Charlie says, look, he can hang out here with me. We're living in this little dump in Venice, but oh well, make the best of it. Go back to school, but, you know, lay off the weed and we're good.
Well, at times you get the feeling that he's self-destructing. So why doesn't anybody stop him from self-destructing? There are a lot of people out there that use drugs to escape the world, that they don't have to face what's going on in their lives, and I learned that's not the way you do things. You've got to just head on and just figure, okay, I got to deal with this. No matter what, it's not going to change anything. I mean, I lost my mother-in-law, my sister, and my mother inside of like less than 6 months. And I'm saying, you just have to deal with it. You just deal with it one step at a time. And you can't fall back because they wouldn't want you to. So why doesn't anybody stop him from self-destructing?
Wonderful question, but back to the epidemic, you know, the opiate epidemic and drug addiction in general. Have you ever tried to stop a drug addict? I mean, until the addict himself or herself is personally motivated to change, and they call that hitting bottom. But it, you know, there's a funny, I don't know, that's kind of an ambiguous term and not that useful a term, but motivated to change. Until that happens, you know, there's, look, I experienced this myself. I went through a period of addiction. It's been a long time now, but my biggest lie I told myself was, it's not that bad, I can handle it. Mm-hmm. And that's what addicts do. It's an element of denial. Not that bad, I can handle it. And they keep moving on, and everybody knows it is that bad, and they can't handle it. Until something happens, I don't know, it's kind of a mystery. Some people can do it before their lives blow up. Other people have to blow everything up and lose everything. So Charlie just doesn't get it until finally he gets it.
Unfortunately, kids don't get it. And they think that smoking, even smoking cigarettes, is horrible.
They think they're bulletproof.
It's scary. It's scary.
Yeah, sure.
Well, who is Daniel, and what does he expect Charlie to do for him now that he's a whole person again?
Okay. Daniel is Charlie's mentor. Charlie is so lost that he needs a mentor. He doesn't know that, and he doesn't listen to Daniel. Daniel's kind of a mysterious character. It turns out in the first book, you'll find out that Daniel was a facilitator in a sort of exotic treatment center dealing with, and it takes place in Mexico because this isn't legal in the United States, and they give you a hallucinogen called Ibogaine. And the Ibogaine treatment supposedly sort of gives you instant spiritual insight into your condition, and you walk away no longer strung out. Some people swear it works. I don't have any experience with it, but Daniel's a facilitator at that particular treatment center in Mexico. And Charlie was his personal client. He oversaw Charlie's treatment. It didn't go as expected. And so Charlie is Daniel's charge, his responsibility. So he keeps popping up here, and he pops up here and there, but he's the only one that has real insight into Charlie's strange condition of being dead but revived.
I think more people need Daniel, seriously.
Yeah, sure. So,
well, the character that I found fascinating, sorry people, was Tamara Gale. Sorry, you know, this was like, I, you know, there are people I know that actually believe in being psychics, and I'm going like, okay. So how and why do people fall for her shows, and what three murders does she predict, and why were they never solved? I'm going like, huh?
Right. Well, you know, people fall for stuff like that because they want to believe. They just do. It gives them comfort to be convinced of an afterlife where they and their loved ones will reunite after death. There's some interesting books that I've read that you might find fun. One's by a guy named Michael Shermer. It's called Why People Believe Weird Things. Carl Sagan wrote something called This Demon-Haunted World. And basically, there's a whole audience out there, you know, it's a big industry. The psychic people write books about their psychic experiences, and people go see psychics. Who is that Spoonbender guy? Uri Geller. You know, people go for stuff like that. Tamara's a hustler. She wants to get ahead. She wants to make a name for herself. She wants to work with the police. She wrote a book. She's interested in her Amazon star rating. And so she's offered the police solutions to, well, three murders. Two of them are teenage boys in Los Angeles, and there's a student in a school in New Mexico. And she offers tantalizingly, well, useful hints to the police, and they have no idea how she got the information, but it bears out. It actually is accurate.
I could use somebody like that, too. You know,
right.
Well, I have a niece that believes in that, and she texted me this morning and said that she got a sign from my sister and her father that everything was going to be fine and that my two nieces are going to pass their tests. And I'm wishing luck to my niece, Danny Nicole, that's taking her nursing exam today. And I truly hope that she passes it because she'll make a great pediatric nurse. And my other niece is taking the test for EMT paramedic. And That's a big deal in this family. So tell us why Jerry Ayers realizes during one of her shows that this one might be a fraud. What would make somebody think that Tamara is not for real?
Well, Jerry Ayers he's patterned after a guy in real life. He's a fraud buster. That's what he does. He writes articles and investigates people like Tamara Gale. And he's based on this real guy who had been a magician called, he was a magician called himself the Amazing Randy. And he, quite a few years ago, put up a reward of, I think at the time it was $100,000, now it's up to $1 million, that if anybody could come into a laboratory environment with video and everything controlled and do things like bend spoons or any kind of thing that psychics claim, you know, actually, telepathy or any of that, prove it, they can get $1 million. And nobody's collected that $1 million yet. So Jerry Ayers is one of these, like he calls himself a fraud buster. He knows she's a fraud from the beginning. And he's been actually assembling a video podcast about her at the show, because they go to see that Charlie and Dave and Jerry go together to see a show by Tamara where she shows off her psychic abilities to her fans at a theater in Santa Monica. And, well, you got to read it to see how it shakes out, but Jerry is alerted to the mechanics of her trick.
You have to read it because we're not going to tell you, and you will spoil
the fun of meeting Charlie
yourself. Sometimes you want to smack him in the head, and sometimes you want to say, oh, good for you, you finally got it.
Yeah.
So she's right on target. Yes, she's not a psychic. So tell us about Philip Gale and why you don't, you know, you think you know him, but you really don't. That's all I'll say about him.
Right. Well, he story is that he's her husband, and he's like the facilitator of her act. He introduces her. He does the footwork to put her acts together. What he really is, again, you have to read it to find out. It's deeper and darker than the show that they put on, which is nice, sweet couple that, you know, he supports her and she looks deeply into the mystery of the afterlife. So that's what it looks like. What it really is, again, you have to read it to find out.
I know, and I'm not going to tell them anything because you don't know.
Okay.
Okay, so every step of the way, this is a great show, seriously, to talk about why people shouldn't take drugs and why they have to be careful. Every step of the way, Charlie uses drugs to deal with every situation. And when wanting to find out about someone or something, this was really cool. Why did you create a way where he could remove his head from his body and hover over when something happened or might happen? And I bet people would like to be able to rip their heads off, too, and see what's going on. So, and how does he get his body back? How does he get his head back on his body? That was like,
okay.
Huh?
Well, now I'm going, huh? Because if I inferred that he removed his head from his body, I hope I didn't do that. Or let's go back a bit. He doesn't remove his head from his body. His body is one thing, and he's sort of a ghostly. Well, it's kind of like astral projection. He, you know, sort of has a ghostly experience of leaving the body or going back to the body. The body is intact except for a bullet hole that he eventually gets to repair. But so how does he reintegrate in his body? Again, in the beginning of the first book, it pulls him in, and then he finds out that he can either run the body, which I call roaming in the book, or he calls it that, or he can leave the body, in which case the body just sits there or lies there limp and useless until he gets back to it. He can gather information that's useful for his moving forward in the mystery of, you know, that he's trying to solve, but he can't leave the body for too long because there's a price to pay. And he might never get back to it if he goes too far or stays too long. So how he does it, again, there's just no answer to that.
He just does.
Yes.
I think the rest of us want to know how. Well, you'll
have
to read the book to find out, because maybe Charlie will be nice enough to write the next one and tell you. So tell us about Captain Van Evra and his relationship with Dave. Why does Dave seem to gravitate to trouble? And why does he often Charlie along and create Charlie and dish out their own brand of justice and get away with it? Why Shink is really cool. So how does that relationship work?
Well, okay, Van Evra is the captain of the police, and he's a politician. His job is to please the mayor and the city council, and that's often contrary to getting real work done. So that, in turn, creates conflict for Dave, who's just a cop on the street. So inevitably, Dave has to go renegade and play by his own rules.
Well, let's see. When dealing with Tamara, what happens when Jerry says he's going to out her, and then we won't say anything else about Jerry? I don't want to give anything away.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be a coincidence, or there could be a connection. That's up to Charlie and Dave to figure out.
I know, that's it.
Right.
What happens to poor him? So dealing with Charlie, Dave can become frustrated, and he can become, you know, upset. So dealing with Charlie can be cautious because he seems like a rogue PI, and he doesn't want to follow the rules. So describe his personality. How would you think most rational people might view him?
Might view Dave? Well, Dave himself is a bit of a renegade, and on the other hand, Charlie crosses the line for him, and eventually Dave has to decide whether he wants to cross that line as well. I mean, they're both in this thing together. They've already gone renegade together. They're fully committed. I still have you? Hello? Okay, I can't hear you from my end.
How do they skirt the police? How come they don't, you know, get caught?
Okay, I lost you for about 30 seconds there, so.
How do they skirt the police? How come the police don't go after them?
After Charlie and Dave?
Yeah.
My
computer's being ridiculous again. It's okay.
Oh, is that it? Okay.
Yeah.
The police aren't after. They have some pretty close encounters with the police, but
yeah.
Dave has some authority, and he works his way out of it, and then he convinces the higher-ups that he's onto something, and they give him some leeway, but they finally discredit him and say, look, you know, you're off the case. And, I mean, this is sort of a standard trope in the whole, independent cop kind of drama anyway. A lot of movies do this. The cop's out on his own. He has to solve everything on his own. He is vindicated at the end, even though he stirred up a lot of a big mess, which is what they do together. Charlie and Dave just leave a lot of destruction behind them because they're after something bigger.
So tell us about the drone operation and how they figured that out. That was really cool. And I love things with drones because drones are like the latest thing. I mean, they're all over the place, and they can fly. They can monitor things. And one of these days, unfortunately, they're going to take over the world. So tell us about that drone operation.
I don't want to see one over my backyard. Do you?
Neither do I.
You're right. So in the book, okay, in Down to No Good, someone uses a hobby drone. Sprays poison gas at students at a high school football game. So Dave, the cop, investigates. He finds a student who saw someone who looked like he was playing a video game on a laptop in his car in the school parking lot. And the student who saw the person in the car playing the video game said the guy had a weird identifying feature. So Dave puts that together with the person that we find out is one of two perpetrators in the plot.
That is so scary. A lot of the books that I'm reading now have drones in it. It's scary. There was one where there was a thing at a stadium and the drones actually beat the people. Oh my God. So when Tamara is found out, she tells everyone at the show that something is going to happen, but does not reveal what, where, or why. So this is a cliffhanger in the story when Charlie and Dave take matters into their own hands, get in trouble, and dish out what you would call minor justice. How would you define that? I thought that was really cool.
Let's see. Let's back up. So Tamara has a grand strategy. She's giving revelations to the police. She's telling them, she's shown them useful information about several murders, and then she gave them useful information, but vague, not really pinpointing what's happening, but enough to uncover the high school where the poison gas was sprayed with the drone, and it's all sort of tantalizing, but they can't really figure out how she got the information, but they have to run with it. And the trouble is the information, the fact that the LAPD is getting information that they can't get through normal investigative procedure, but they get from a psychic, doesn't make the cops look very good. It's bad for the department's image. So they don't like this. The higher-ups don't like this. They want Dave to handle it. So anyway, Tamara has this grand strategy. She's escalating the pitch of her revelations. You know, she's a self-promoter. She's trying to get on television. She wants her own show. She wants to sell a lot of books. She wants to be a celebrity. So she's escalating. And she at this show, the one in Santa Monica at the theater that Dave and Charlie go to, she predicts a real catastrophe. And so it's vague, but it compels Charlie and Dave to use any means necessary, because she says a lot of people are going to die and suffer.
Oh, wow. Before I forget, because I don't want to forget, next Tuesday, Countdown, Carrie Baldwin. On the 23rd, Child of Creation, Robert Donohue. On the 26th, I am totally, and I can't believe this, Deputy Attorney General Rick Acker joins us for Guilty Blood. On the 29th, New York Times author Matt Coyle for Blood Truth. And nothing like starting off February with one of my favorite people in the whole world, Dennis Palumbo, Head Wounds. And that's just some. And we've got on the 13th, we've got The Shepherd's Calculus. And on the 15th, we have No Fury Like That. And on the 28th, I booked my last show for February, The Voice Inside, New York Times author Brian Freeman. And that's just February. March is filled too, just about. I don't know how I did this, but yeah. So tell us and those books you should read. And if you haven't read Down to No Good and the first one, then you should go get one, because, you know, Easter is coming up and people need presents for every holiday. Actually, Valentine's Day is coming up, so you take the roses and you take the chocolate and stick a couple of books in. No, I'm serious.
Right.
That would be my present. Anybody that ever buys me a book, they're on my list forever. So who is Zena? Why did Charlie hook up with her? Yeah, Zena's an interesting character, too.
Right. Well, Zena, okay, well, first of all, she's Tamara's daughter. She's a drug addict, and she doesn't like her parents. She doesn't like Tamara. She doesn't like Philip Gale. And she is a videographer. She's actually documenting her mother's rise as a psychic, but she wants to poke holes in it and show that her mom's a fraud because she hates her mom. She's also a drug addict. And so she winds up hooking up with Charlie, and of course they wind up doing drugs together.
That is bad.
And that doesn't go well for either of them.
No, it doesn't. So she hooks up with her, uses drugs, and does a few other things that we won't talk about. And Charlie seems to care about his daughter and Dave and creating justice, and dislikes the rule, following the rules, even if he gets hurt with the law. So what happens when Huerta and her partner Morales knock on the door and take control of the matters? Tell us about them.
This is one of the places where Dave overrides her authority. And because he's onto something, again, he's been assigned, his mission from Van Evra is to take care of this whole Tamara Gale PR problem for the police, because she's making the police department look pretty goofy because she's solving crimes that they can't. So Dave pulls some strings, pulls rank on Huerta, and she then becomes part of the team.
Well, I'm looking at page 200. See, I keep the book in front of me, people, because it makes it easier for me to quote. This book, even though it's got some graphic scenes and stuff, is probably a good way to teach people in their 20s, maybe even young adults, why they shouldn't use drugs. This would be a very good, you know, resource or talking point. So there's a protest, and then we have signs, and people are holding up signs that say "Stop making our children sick and supporting emission controls." How do emission controls fall into this? And it is poison. You have to be careful. So why did you include that as part of the book? That's interesting too.
Okay, the protest at the end, and here's a spoiler alert, you actually don't want to know this if you're going to read the book, so I'm going to be careful what I say, they're talking, the signs that are being held up have to do with emission controls, and it has to do with an oil and gas refinery. It's a protest. It actually doesn't have to do with the drug issue. The drug issue is Charlie's, and by the way, not only does he have a drug issue, but his partner Dave Kopp has an alcohol problem. So the two of them together are just one raging mess, and they barely get through the book without killing each other or themselves just by nature of their own demons. But the signs and all that, that has to do with the environment that Tamara ensnares them in. She pulls them into this environment where the final, you know, what's going to harm all these people? What is the nature of her prediction that she made, that where she saw people being, where she saw so many people being hurt? She swooned in front of her audience and fell to the stage floor saying, oh, it's terrible, it's terrible. And she's supposedly having this trance vision of horrible things happening, which leads Charlie and Dave to where they wind up on page 200. And they see these signs, and it tells, it finally puts the whole puzzle piece, the last puzzle piece together as to what's going on.
Would you say that Charlie cares about people, and he feels his mission might be to help anyone in trouble at any cost? Why is that? He's willing to risk himself, too. He doesn't care.
Well, here's the thing, you know, Charlie has spent a long time as a drug addict who only thought about himself, which is one of the key features of addiction, of self-absorption. So his redemption comes from awakening to the idea that helping is incidentally self-serving, but the consequences are better for him and for other people.
Well, I guess if he, you know, maybe he's in the wrong profession. Maybe he should be a counselor of some type. He needs a profession, actually. What did he do before all of this? What was his job at all before he did this? Because I didn't read the first one. What was he
out
he was dead?
He's always been a private investigator, but he's kind of a two-bit, you know, he chases down people that are doing insurance fraud or missing persons cases or cheating husbands, that kind of thing. That's just what he's good at.
Yeah. Well, I know. Somebody said I should try to do that because I'm pretty good at reading people, but no, it's okay.
Is that right? Okay.
I don't want to find out what somebody else is doing because then I would have to actually do something about it, and they may not like what I did. So if Charlie could speak out to our readers, what would he say as far as his life and what he learned? What would he say?
I don't know if Charlie has developed enough insight to say anything useful about his experience, but he certainly knows that addiction is a trap and that it starts off solving one problem and it winds up creating many more. And so I'm sure he could articulate at least that much.
Do you think he would redo it the same way? Do you think he would live his life the same way? Or do you think he would change the drug addiction? Now that he knows what it causes, do you think he would change or do you think he's going to continue on? But that's up to you because you're writing the book, not me.
Well, there's a sequel coming. I have it sketched out.
Yeah?
I don't think that the addiction theme has to be played again. Charlie's, there's more to Charlie than the fact that he will be a recovering addict. That will be part of his past. Maybe it'll be part of his future. I actually don't know yet. But I'll tell you
this. You have to write it. You have to decide. You have to decide. I can't decide for you. Yeah. Go on.
so here's a fun thing. You mentioned Matt Coyle being on your show. And Matt Quayle lives here, I believe, in San Diego. I know Matt, and we have a mutual friend who was a cop for 35 years. His name in real life is Dave Putnam. He's a really good writer. He's written about 5 books. He's a friend of mine, And he let me use his name and his kind of persona in my book. So the Dave Putnam in my book is based on a real Dave Putnam, who was a cop, who is also a writer. And so here's a fun thing. We're just working on it now. We got our first gig coming up in a month at Mysterious Galaxy here in San Diego. And we're doing a panel called Two Writers, Opposite Sides of the Law. And we're just going to swap stories about wanting to be writers when we were kids and going on. No, he became a cop. I might as well say it here live to your listeners. I'm not proud of it, but I went into the opposite direction and was in the drug business for, well, way too long. Just about killed me. I was trying to be a musician up in Los Angeles. And so I have a criminal background, and Dave has a law enforcement background. So he was the guy, the real Dave Putnam, the guy that chased people like me around. And so now we're friends, and we're going to have this panel, and we're going to talk about using our past experiences and turning them into fiction.
Well, guess what? Are you ready for this one?
Yeah, tell me.
Ocean View Press sent me his book. I'm reading it as we speak, The Innocents.
Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. I picked it up
yesterday. I have 40 books to read. And
yes.
The publicist sends me them, and I said, oh, my God, this one's due out in February. Now, you have to understand that I'm reading Mark Cameron. I'm interviewing him with the Tom Clancy book. And the book has taken me a while. I'm reading The Most Hated Man in the World, Jerry Sandusky, and I have to finish that one. I've got about—I don't even know. I got a whole pile inside. I've got Nora Roberts, Year One.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting Lisa Gardner's book, and then all of a sudden, yesterday, and I read about 100 pages already in like a half an hour. I picked up The Innocents, and I go, wait a minute. This character is great. And, I mean, it starts off with, I can give away the first chapter, where this poor guy's a cop and says girlfriend leaves him with her child, with a child, and he's a father and didn't know that he was a father. And that's all I'll say about it. It's been, you could tell Dave I love it. If he wants to do an interview on my show, he can contact
me.
Right now.
Right now, as you're speaking, I just got an email from Dave Putnam.
Well,
so
I knew it was him in your book, and I'm saying, oh, my God, I just picked up his book, The Innocent, and I love Bruno. I love the character. You see, I told you, I really did read it.
Yeah.
And he's got to watch who he trusts. So you said the ending leaves more room for a sequel. So when is the ending coming, the sequel coming, and tell us about it? We have about 5 or 6 more minutes.
So, okay, tell me again, what's next?
What's next? Tell us about the sequel. I want to know what Charlie and Dave are up to. And you're going to include Mindy in there, right? You can't leave her out.
I don't know. It's sketched out. All I know is Charlie's going to go to Alaska. I'm not sure.
Oh, nice.
Maybe I'll ask him, you know, Charlie, what's up? What's next? Because Charlie's got to tell me. That's the creative process. I have no idea where these ideas come from. They spill out. They generate themselves, and then I sort of have to craft them into something hopefully readable. Charlie has some money set aside from the first book that he actually wound up making out pretty well in the first book, but he has these assets. He's going to invest them, and it's going to be the rip-off investment. So he's going to have to go up to Alaska to find out where his money went.
Well, before I forget, Cheryl was listening, and she wants your book. You have to send it to her from Partners in Crime. She's listening, and she just emailed me, and she said she would like the book too because she knows that if Fran likes it, it's got to be first rate.
Okay. Am I sending the first book, the second book, both books?
I think she wants both of them. Well, we'll make her read both of them. But they make me read everything. And I read them, like, before I start anything, if it says Partners in Crime, I'll go, wait a minute, I better do this right now. So I just read No Fury Like That in about an hour and a half, and that's a book about people going to purgatory. That's all I'll say. It was really good. It was interesting.
Perfect.
But before I forget, tonight at 6:05, believe it or not, this girl right here is going to be interviewed on KLC 560 AM, 100.7 FM, Rush to the Reason, and they're going to talk about my new book called A Daughter's Promise. The promise is, everybody, that I promised not to put my mom in a nursing home. My mom had Alzheimer's. And for those of you that have family members that have Alzheimer's, that are caregivers, this book is a research. It's a great, great resource to help you understand what I went through for 11 years, taking care of my mom. And many times I was told by many doctors, put her away. And I said, put yourself away. That will never happen. It's expensive until you get full services. And I was in debt, a lot of money when she died. But to be very honest, I had to do it again. I do it the same way. Because she had 6 home health aides that became my family. So for those of you that don't know, I'm going to brave it. They're going to ask me the questions. I have no idea what they're going to ask. But you know what? It'll be fine. So before we go, where can everybody find out more about you and your work? And when the next one comes out, I get it first because I need to know what happened next. So seriously.
Okay, great. Well, you can find out more about me at my website, www.earljavorsky.com. Let me spell that, earljavorsky.com. And I'd love to hear from you. There's a contact me page there. There's something on each of my 3 books. I wrote another book called Trust Me. That's not a Charlie Miner book, nor is it supernatural. I hope I can send that to you as well. Maybe you'll get a kick out of that.
Okay, Cheryl wants the 3rd book too. I'm just telling you.
She's right on it. Okay, good.
Before I forget, I don't want to forget. Yeah. I got reminded just by a text just now. Marcia Casper Cook was listening, and she thought that this was really interesting. And she's roped me into doing a brand new kind of show. People, no books, no discussion, no literary thing. We're going to talk about fashion and style starting in February. What's your style when it storms? That's our first one. We're going to talk about shopping. We're going to talk about movies. We're going to talk about things of interest. And we might even talk about Alzheimer's and anything that has nothing to do with books so that we can have sort of like a light, fun show. But the first one's going to be about something I know a lot about, jewelry and fashion, and why you don't have to shop high-end to look good. No, seriously. So I want to thank you a million times. This is great. As I said, I'm doing a show on opiates on February 8th. And if you or David would like to join me on that, we're going to talk about what happens to people when they use it and what they have to learn, and the fact that Kate's son died of it, Chris Gino, and the fact that Brody in Michael's book, we don't know what happened to him yet because he left it open-ended. And basically, Michael just sent me the book, and I'm really glad he did. So I want to thank everyone today. Thank you so much. The sun is beautiful outside. Like I said, we're having a heat wave. It's 38 degrees going down. So it's not going up. And everybody have a nice day. Earl, thank you a million times. And please tell Dave if he would like to contact me. My email is gabina49@gmail.com. And if he would like to do an interview on my show after I read the book, I can give him a date in March. But I'm reading it, and his review is going to come out next month, and I promise no spoilers. It'll be good. Thank you so much. Everybody have a nice day.
I'll tell him in a couple minutes.
Thank you.
And thank
bye.
You. Okay.